And by the way, if you're new and you haven't had an interview and you didn't arrange one, or if I cancel on you, which is about half the people in the class, catch me during the break and we'll reschedule it.
If you're new, you have to have an interview. If you're new to this class, you can't miss any more classes because you missed two. And that's all you can miss. How to take the bodhisattva vows. You can start out by the two divisions of bodhisattva, bodhicitta. Say muntem. As I repeat, you don't have to learn anything about them. Just make the noises, okay? Muntem.
Juksem.
Muntem.
Juksem.
Muntem, these are the two great divisions of bodhicitta. What do they mean? Muntem means what? Muntem is the wish in the form of a prayer. I translate it that way. It's the wish for enlightenment in the form of a prayer, meaning an intention. That's just wishing you could do it, wanting to do it. It's like wanting to go away for the weekend. Right? It's during the week, okay? Up to Friday afternoon, you have muntem. You'd like to get out of the city for the weekend. So what do you guess juksem is? That's getting out of the city, okay? That starts Friday afternoon and goes on until Sunday afternoon.
Okay.
And juksem is where you're actually doing it. It's the state of mind in which you're actually doing it. We already talked about that. By the way, is muntem so difficult to get? It's a very high level of Buddhism. If you ever get to that in this life, it'll be a great thing. You can have feelings of wanting to help other people, but to really get to this, as the speaker said last week, you have to look at every single being on the subway and feel like they're your only child. That kind of affection for them, which is almost impossible. Supposed to be a little bit easier if you think about their situation. The situation is, if you studied the Karma course and you studied the Diamond Cutter Sutra course, you know what their situation is. Things are empty. They're being forced to have certain projections. Right now they're having a perception of a human being's life. They have a job maybe, they have a wife maybe, they have kids maybe. And all these perceptions are being forced on them by their past karma. Their past karma is throwing up information to them, and they see the world and themselves in a certain way. It's suffering. In itself, it will always have suffering. There's something wrong with the process of projection. They will always have suffering. It's just built into that process. They must suffer while they're alive. But the worst part is when they die. When they die, all the karmic stuff goes back to zero. You're not even a human anymore. You don't even have a human thoughts anymore. You don't have the privilege of seeing New York City anymore. All the karma that's around you now and keeping holding you up, even in this miserable life, in one moment it cuts off, and then you're back to zero. Mickey Mantle is back to zero. He's not even human right now. He's not even in a world like this. He's in some terrible suffering, hallucinations, and if he ever gets back to a human level, it'll be a miracle. It'll be extremely rare. So it doesn't matter how beautiful life was, or how great he was, or how much money he got, or how famous he was. It all, the clock is set back again to zero, and he's at zero again. And he's got nothing of what he had before. He can't even see human beings around him anymore. He can't even see this world anymore. He's in some really horrible kind of hallucinations right now. We all start back at zero. We're all in that same situation. The moment you die, then you're back at square one. You don't even have the karma to... Forget studying Dharma. You don't have the karma to live among humans anymore right then. You're in a different realm and you're in a different kind of existence, and it's very chaotic and crazy and horrible. So we're all in that situation, and it's just a race against time. But before we cross that line, we have to do something, because you have a body, and you have eyes, and you have ears, and you can speak, and you can read, and you can think, and you can try to improve things before you cross that line. So that's not hard to think of. I mean, everyone's in the same situation. We'll all start back at zero. When the moment comes. And it could come tonight, we don't know. It could come anytime for any of us. We had, we're counting who's going to be the first student that died. We already had one. He used to sit in that chair over there. And he was a terrible death. And there'll be a number two, there'll be a number three. You know, we'll say, oh, she was number three, he was number one. And we'll come. It's a question of who and when. So that's Munsem. Munsem is, I wish I could do something about it. I wish I could help you. And then Juksem is actually doing it.
Michael, the first one is you must have all sentient beings,
that
now.
Yeah, Munsem.
It must be the month.
Yeah, there is a thing called sugarcane bodhicitta, which is sweet but hollow. And that comes before real bodhicitta, where you kind of start to get emotions of wishing you could help people, but it's not the real thing. The real thing is very difficult to reach. Obviously, the day when you feel about that, when you get on the subway and feel that way about everybody. But if you think about them as the Mickey Mantle thing, it'll be a lot easier for you. You know, it's hard, with your present perception of people, it's hard to love them. But see them in that kind of trouble, and you start to get a brotherly feeling for them. And you have to see them in that kind of trouble before you can get that feeling.
Michael, can I ask a question? Yeah. I've been really thinking about this. There's so much striving to reach nirvana. And I was thinking about the after-death state. Wouldn't it be more, you know, bodhisattva-like to prepare and to, you know, kind of help these beings, which is a bigger torture than being in a body.
In the body?
Yeah.
We can't contact them. They can't.
No, I'm not talking, you know, I'm doing our state of death instead of, you know, making it possible for us to zip to nirvana, which everybody's hope is, be able to function on that level, because it is possible for us to learn that. And to help those who are crossing and are totally, you know, going crazy.
It's one of the things to be nice to. But generally, it's too late to help people at that point. Generally speaking, it's too late for them to make any great progress at the moment of death. They can't hear properly, they can't understand properly, they're frightened. You know, take somebody up on a tall building, get them near the edge, hold on to them tight, but go like that, and then say some Dharma to them and see how much they It's the same thing. They're in more fear than death. They're in more fear than death at that moment. The odds of them hearing anything or logically thinking anything or changing their attitude at the last minute is very, very infinitely small. And that's why the practice of poi is not that. It's not meant for that. It's not meant that you don't practice during your whole life and then suddenly at the last minute you are able to do something miraculous. It's not like, that's not what it is. I mean, that conception is spreading among Americans. You know, I don't have to worry. Poa means like some kind of consciousness transfer at the last minute. It's not what it's for. And then B, it wouldn't work. I mean, it wouldn't work in a normal person who tried it at the last minute like that. It's too late. You have to change now while you're healthy and while you can hear and understand.
What is Poa for?
Long story. Okay. Juksem. So taking the vows would naturally follow this pattern. And as early as Nagarjuna, who lived when? 200 AD. Okay, 1700 years ago. Roughly, we don't know. I mean, we really don't know very much. But people say probably about 200. In his early text on how to take the vows, all he has is a ritual for getting this wish in your heart. He doesn't mention the vows. All he has is a ritual for saying, okay, I pledge to try to get this wish in my mind. I pledge to try to commit myself to this wish. And someone goes and takes an actual vow that, okay, for the rest of my life, I'll try to reach that state where I really see everybody like as my own child. So the question is, where do you get the vows? Then Jethro Kapa talks about it, and he shows that Nagarjuna's ritual actually includes taking the vows. There are later writers who say, oh, let's have a separate ritual for these two. We'll have a ritual where you go in front of a lama and you say, I'm going to try to develop this wish, and I'm going to try to do what I can to help other beings. And then they say, what's Domba?
Vow.
Domba means vow. Then they say there should be another ritual for taking the vow. So they say, by the way, this is a wrong idea, okay? There have been a few writers who said, let's have one ritual for pledging to the wish. I'll try to get this attitude. I'll try to develop this attitude. And I'll do what I have to do to help other beings. And then they come back later, 6 months later, and take the vow. And Jetsun Kapa, he shows that that's not correct. That's not the way it is. So how is it really? That's your first homework question. In general, when you take the vows, in that same ceremony, you swear to try to develop that attitude. So it's only one ceremony. People who were there this last weekend, I mean, he didn't say, okay, go have your tea and come back later and we'll do the second part of the vow, right? He did the whole thing in one shot. And generally, that's the way it's done. You swear to keep the wish, Chanju Chucho's Yon Kepaki, go up and just bring it to the show. And then you take the vows in the same ceremony. But Jetsun Kapa says, Nagarjuna had a great idea, Shantideva had a great idea, it would be even better if people took a separate vow to try to develop the attitude. You just go in front of a lama and say, I swear to try to develop this attitude.
Sorry, Michael, what did you say? You can or you cannot?
Nagarjuna and Shantideva, both Tsongkhapa agrees with them ultimately that if you could take a separate ceremony where you just go to your lama and say, I'm going to swear to try to develop this attitude, and don't talk anything about the vows, then you go home, you spend 6 months or a year, try to develop the attitude itself, and then you'll come back again and say, okay, now I'm ready to take the vows, now I'm ready to do something about it. That would be a separate ceremony. Jetsun Kapa says that would be the best way to do it. That's the best way to... First you go and have a ceremony where you swear that you try to develop the attitude, and then you come back later, that once it's matured a little bit, and you say, okay, now I'm ready to take the vows.
Which kind of encompasses taking the vow and the attitude.
Yeah. So really it divides like this. And really these two things are they go together. I mean, obviously, keeping the vows and doing it, going for the weekend is the same thing. That's Jetsun Kapa really, he tears it apart because there were a lot of strange ideas. In his day in Tibet, Buddhism had gotten pretty strong in Tibet, but it was all mixed up. And he was trying to straighten things out, and he did. And he learned all the ancient scriptures, and he could quote them like boom, 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 and he said, you should have, the best way is to have a ceremony to swear that you're going to get that attitude, and then have a ceremony where you take the vows. Because taking the vows is doing it.
Now, why does that even?
Well, yeah.
Well, normally there are people who do it that way. Yeah.
So what was wrong? You started to say some people have a wrong idea.
Yeah, you said this was a wrong idea.
That's right.
No. Some people divided it this way. They put these two together, the wish and doing something, and then you go and take the vow. That's wrong, because these two are the same thing. Doing it and keeping your vows are the same thing.
Okay. And then
Bodhisattva activity is keeping the vows.
And when Jetsun Kapa says the best way is that you could have two separate ceremonies,
yeah,
for one and two,
yeah,
that when he says the best way, he means it's optional, that you actually can do it that way, or...
It's optional. It's better, he says. It's more... He says tempo. Tempo means... It's going to stick in your mind better. It's going to be a more stable process. First you go and really work on the wish for a long time. Then you say, okay, now I got it, and you come back and you take your vows. So that's the best way.
So what you're saying is that if there has to be a best way, that there are other people who do it the other way.
The best way is to take... to have a ceremony that I want to draw out the attitude, and then a separate ceremony to take the vows later on.
Yes.
Because in between there, you'll have this mind strong. It's wrong to say these two should go together in one ceremony, and then later you should take the vows.
I don't understand how you could even have two things down.
They did. Somebody thought it. Dalai number yao.
But why isn't this the institution?
No, some people do it. Some people do it that way. It is done that way.
The other way?
No. It is done... this way.
Oh, as opposed to just one day.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
But generally, every time I've seen it or I've taken it, it's been together.
Okay.
And how is it done now?
bring.
One big thing.
You just had it.
Hey, one big thing.
One big thing. Oh. Generally now people, especially in a tantric initiation, they generally just pop, throw the whole thing on you with a lot of other things, which by the way brings me to a subject. If you were there last weekend and you're new and you were overwhelmed, don't worry about it. Just do it. Rinpoche, you know, he said, pull me upstairs. He said, tell them, just do it. You know, don't worry. They'll get there. It took 15 years for the people there to learn it the way they did. I remember the first time he ever taught it, he taught it for 7 days in a row. And the first night, we all sat around in a cabin out in the woods and tried to figure out what the hell he said. And Dawn came up. We were still arguing about what did he say, and I remember Don came up and we all went to bed, you know. So don't worry about it. Just do what you can now, and you will, the whole thing will ripen on you, and especially after you do your tantric retreats, there'll be something very fantastic. But there's a hard learning curve.
Okay. Tantric secret.
I don't know anything about that. Bodhisattva vows are the only vows of the three that you're allowed to study before you take them. Mm-hmm. That you should study. Say Jorwa.
Jorwa.
Mershi.
Mershi.
You guys are wimpy. Jorwa.
Jorwa.
Mershi.
Mershi.
Jupa.
Jupa.
Let me change this.
You're not allowed to study makers and vows
before you can. Oh. You can. You actually can. Most, when they say that, they are referring mostly to the monks' vows or Jain vows. Jorwa means the preliminaries. Okay.
Michael, for example, yeah. Not vowing to be celibate, you know, that you know
don't
have enough to study, so
it's
not a secret.
There's 253 vows, and you can't study them. You can't. Mushi means, I don't know how to translate that, but you help me. Mushi means the main event. Okay. It means like, you know, like at this event we're going to have fruit juice, I hope, and a little music, you know, and that's the Jorwa. And people are going to come in and mingle, and then there'll be the Mushi, which is the auction, you know, we try to hit everybody up. And then the Jukchok, which is the wrap-up, will be, you know, we'll get up and thank everybody, and people will go get their coats and, you know, try to find their checkbooks, and you know, that's a jukchok. So jukchok means the wrap up or the conclusion, I guess. What do you want to call it? Bumushi? I don't know.
Just bow. The actual bow.
Well, it's also a word that applies to like when you're reaching certain meditative levels.
The commitment taken.
Commitment taken. Bumushi means the main, the actual event, the actual. How about actual event?
Actual. Primary activity.
It's where they actually give you the vows. It's where they say, they repeat something and you repeat something and then you have the vows. There's a lot to do before that. There's a lot of warm-up before that. I'm going to go through the warm-up with you, alright? There are five parts to the warm-up. As in many Buddhist things, the warm-up is more important than the main event. It's like when you go to meditate. If you do your warm-up properly, the meditation will go fantastic. If you just flop down and try to meditate, you won't get anywhere. And for years, you'll wonder why you didn't get anywhere. So the warm-up is really important. The main event lasts about 30 seconds. Okay? The warm-up is a big, long story. Sola Dapa, you know the verb sola in depth, okay? But this is another form of it. Sola Dapa means to request. This is where you ask the Lama to give the vow. Yeah.
This is part one of number one?
It's the first part of the preliminaries. It's the first of five parts of the preliminaries.
So this would be like 1A?
Yeah, 1A out of E. A, B, C, D, E. Jetsun Karpa at this point takes the opportunity to describe a lot of other subjects, which I'll do also. First he says, what about the person taking the vow? What should they be like? What are the requirements for the person who's taking the vow? First thing is they can be ordained or not ordained. This vow anyone can take. You have to be a human, I guess. But anyone can take this vow. human, I mean, ordained or non-ordained. You don't have to be ordained to take this vow. By the way, you don't even have to be a human to have this vow. Why? Yeah, you don't lose it when you die. So there's beings in other realms who have what they call automatic bodhisattva vows. They were not really automatic, but they just took them in a human life and then they died and went to a deity's life, and they have that vow. The other requirement of the person is that they should have at least munsim in some form, not in its real pure form. What is munsim? Where they really have that attitude. Yeah, they really have that motivation. They want to do something for all living beings. Even if it's wimpy, okay, even if it's half-hearted, they gotta have some kind of intention as they take the bodhisattva path.
Well, there would have to be more than wimpy motivation. The understanding may not be the full part.
Well, what I mean is, it's not at all a requirement that it be true munsen, because that's very rare. It's extremely rare. So they just generally have to have a fuzzy motivation that they'd like to help all senses.
What is the Sova Dapa?
Sova Dapa means, this is the first of the five preliminaries, and it means to make the request to the Lama. But while we're on that subject, we're describing who's making the request and who's hearing the request. The person making the request can be ordained or not. They must have this motivation, even if it's not pure bodhicitta, which is very rare. They have to intend to keep the vows. They have to intend to keep the three moralities. They have to want to keep the three moralities. You can be in that. It's very much like a monk's vows. If you're a monk and you go through the ceremony, but in the back of your mind you don't intend to keep the vows, if you have any other motivation, and there's a list of them, you know, you want free food, you don't want to work anymore, you'd like to hang out in the monastery, someone forced you, there's a whole list. The vows don't even form. You never get the vows. You can wear your robes your whole life, you can become the abbot of the monastery, whatever, but actually the vows don't actually form in your mind state. So you have to intend to keep the vows. If you don't intend to keep the vows, if you're just there because someone else went, or if you're just there because someone forced you to go, or there was peer pressure or something like that, the vows don't even form. It's very interesting. Yeah.
Are there different vows in the Hinayana and Mahayana Buddhism?
Say again?
Are there different vows in Mahayana?
For a monk?
Yes.
No, our vows are Hinayana. The monk's vows are one of the 18 schools of Hinayana. So our whole monk's system, and there was a big debate about it, and they voted for it in Tibet. And that's the way it is. We follow basically the same vows as the monks in Thailand and Sri Lanka. So those are the requirements of the person taking a vow. And we'll talk about, yeah.
You said they should keep the three vows?
The three moralities.
Which would, distinguishing Thailand monks from Tibetan monks, is it the case that all Tibetan monks have the bodhisattva vow?
Not at all. Okay. You're not required to take the bodhisattva vow.
All right, so then that would be a Hinayana monk in the midst of a Tibetan monastery?
If that's all he ever studied. We study, it's off the subject and I don't want to use up the time, but frankly, in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery, we study the Hinayana schools better than the Hinayana schools. We spend 10 years on Abhidhamma. And the Tibetans study it very, very well, very thoroughly, and they have a great respect for it. It's breaking a vow not to respect it. Abhidhamma and the logic schools, some parts of the logic schools that we study for 15 years every winter are Hinayana, and we love it, and it's great, and it's fantastic, it's very useful. So, no problem. Okay? But not to be practiced only. It's a basis on which to practice Mahayana. So that's Sova Dapa. Now, what should the person who gives you the vows, what should he be like? Okay. Or she? She doesn't have to be ordained. Person does not have to be ordained. Better if they are, but not necessary. There should be someone who could give you the higher to the other vows if you chose to take them, like your secret vows. That would be good. That would be best, but not necessary.
So
it'd be good if they could give you other kinds of vows also, like tantric vows, but not necessary.
Later?
Yeah, later. So that would be good. And by the way, a lot of people in history have taken their bodhisattva vows first, and then by keeping them, gained such an appreciation for morality that then later they became monks. That's very common in history. I mean, that's the connection. If you're keeping your bodhisattva vows well and you really understand what's going on, and you start to get the results of keeping that morality, then you actually, there have been, you know, in history, great political figures who have decided to, after a while, to take their monk's vows. And that's a pretty common track, although you wouldn't think of it like that. Yeah?
Why would that be so? I mean, if you're taking your bodhisattva vows, but you're too much focused there, why become a monk?
You weren't in the first class. No, they just built on each other. They're like this. They're very, very much tied together. To keep your what we call pratimoksha morality, which for a minimum you're avoiding the 10 non-virtues, and then at maximum becoming a full reordained monk. It's fantastic to have that and bodhisattva vows together. That's the best combination you can have. You can do it, you know, you've got to try to do that. At least some kind of lifetime vows if you can.
What is it? Does it help you
to fulfill your... Oh, yeah. Beautiful. And both of them help you fulfill your tantric vows. In fact, you can't succeed in your higher vows without taking some kind of lower vows or some kind of commitment to those moralities, which you can read in the reading. Okay. So that's the Wadzapa. What else? The person who's giving you the vows can be a man or a woman, can be a layman or ordained. They should have the wish also, munsem. So they don't have to have it in a 100% form, but they should at least have some motivation to help all living beings. If they have taken their vows and then lost that motivation, you cannot take your vows from them. You should not take your vows from them. Yeah.
Really mean that they should or they have to have it in some form, not perfect it, but they must
have
it.
Yeah, they must have it. If you're aware that they don't have it, you shouldn't take your vows from that person.
Well, you couldn't take it.
If you're aware that, well, it's just you shouldn't. Okay.
So you could get the vows from somebody who doesn't have it.
Not really.
No.
Doesn't the person who gives them to you have to?
Yeah, he has to have his vows. His or her vows. I wrote it the first thing today. So they must have the intention. They must be keeping their vows well. They must be living that life. Yeah.
Let's just say that someone has the vow. You think they have the vow.
That's in
your
the
motivation best, right. Is that you believe they have the vow. Yeah. It's their karmic result, not your karmic result.
It comes in the monk's morality also, you know, like we're supposed to take the vow, our vows, from a certain person who gives us monk's vows has to have certain characteristics. They're actually quite difficult for any one person to have them. And the thing is, that the bottom line is, if you truly believe that they have the vows, and you'll see that in some of the bodhisattva vows, it's all right. That's you can't ever tell for sure if they have it.
Right.
And you can't tell for sure
coming from you.
If they, more. You have to truly believe that they have it. And they have to appear to have them. They must have that. They must not have screwed up in their six perfections. Okay. They must not have degenerated in their practice of the six perfections. And then Jetsun Kapa gives a long list of what that means. He goes through each perfection. And I'll read it to you what he says. He says, failing in the first perfection would be what we call failing in Dirchum Chokshe. Say Dirchum.
Dirchum Chokshe.
This word appears first in Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha. It's very important in the practice of developing meditation.
Can you spell that?
Dirchung means doesn't want much. Okay? It means not attached to things, not running around the world trying to get more things. That's Dirchung. Dir means desire, Chung means little. So Dirchung means doesn't want much. Chokshe means satisfied with whatever they get. And the scripture says lousy food, lousy drink, lousy place to sleep, lousy place to stay, lousy clothes. Whatever they get, they're happy. They say, okay, that's enough for me. I don't need more than that. They don't go out and tear down the world to get more things and to have the finest of everything. Whatever comes to them, they say, okay, that's enough for me. And Jetsun Kapa says, if a person has failed in this practice, they're attached to objects and things, then they failed in the first perfection. And you shouldn't take your vows from a person like that. Failing in the practice of morality, he gives two examples. One would be a monk who had broken one of his main four vows. So if they call it Pamba. Pamba means one of the four most serious vows for a monk. So if the person had broken one of those four and he were ordained, you shouldn't take your vows from a person like that.
Is it P-A-M-B-A?
P-A-M-P-A. Pamba. Secondly, if they're a person who doesn't have respect for morality or vows in general, if they've lost their respect for morality, if they talk bad about it, if they say, doesn't matter, you don't need that one, that one's not so important, that one's kind of hard to keep, you know. Yeah, if you see that they're developing a bad attitude towards vows, then you shouldn't take it from them. Because they have failed in their second perfection. Third perfection, he says, a person who gets upset easily, who gets angry easily, and then especially who keeps the anger in a flow. They would have failed in the perfection of
patience,
which is really the perfection of not getting angry. We don't have a word in English, I don't think, that fits it perfectly. Don't take your vows from a person like that. By the way, in all the scriptures, when you get to the end of these descriptions, they say, but if you can't find anybody else, in 1995, you know, where are you going to find a pure person? You know? So they say, you know, if all you have available is a pretty okay person, then do it. And they say, at least he's keeping, or she is keeping morality, concentration, and wisdom, you know, in some kind of serious form. Because if you go out, as we have the description of a real lama several times. And if you went out and tried to find a person like that, you know, you might spend a long time. But that, not to say that you should settle for less. You should try to find a person like that.
Can you take a person from another religion and tell them, this is what I want you to say to me and take your vow?
I don't think so, because they'd have to be taking refuge. They would have to have taken refuge.
So there's more.
Yeah.
You can find a very holy person that doesn't has never heard of Buddha.
But they wouldn't. One of the requirements of the teacher, which I didn't get to yet, is they have to know the ritual very well. They have to know all the vows very well. They have to be able to explain them to you. They have to understand your responses during the ritual. They have to know the ritual very well. They have to know the whole literature on bodhisattva activities very well.
They have to have the vows as well.
We talked about that. They have to be keeping their vows.
Yeah, right. So how would somebody from another religion?
Yeah, can't keep their
vows. Of course you can keep the vows. I mean, there must be logic in vows.
No, I mean, they're not. They haven't studied those vows, taken those vows, and keeping those specific vows.
Hard time.
Okay, they can be like a bodhisattva, or they could be a bodhisattva disguised.
Could you put this as the four main vows that he would have broken if he failed in perfection number two?
Killing a human being. What's the fifth perfection?
Fourth.
Yeah, you know, Rinpoche was reading a book the other day, he got to the word zest, and I thought, you know, zest is a pretty good word for it, because it's joy and it's effort together. And really, that's the fourth perfection. That's the meaning of the fourth perfection. So, talking about zest, what would be the opposite of that?
Lethargy.
Yeah, okay. It's a person who they've lost their zest for Dharma, and you've met people like that. You know, first they have a lot of zest for Dharma, and then they just get lazy. They're not much interested in anymore. They don't have any great drive to do good things anymore. They don't have much interest in the whole thing anymore. That's a person who's degenerated in his fourth perfection. Number five. Number five is concentration, and that's the example is that a person who's easily distracted from his meditations, like get down, start to meditate, and then say, oh, you know, I forgot there's a real good video I wanted to watch. I mean, the mind, I mean, as the person sits down, the mind starts, you know, oh, this is what I got to eat for lunch, I got to get this, I got to go to the store today, and they're degenerated in that perfection. The sixth one is wisdom, and they say the opposite of that is just a person who has become spiritually stupid. In other words, and this happens, it's the direct result of two kinds of problems. One is breaking your morality a lot. If you break your morality a lot, you start to lose your ability to concentrate on Dharma. You begin to lose your ability to understand the finer points, like Madhyamika, things like that. You begin to lose your ability to memorize things. And especially with putting down Mahayana. If you put down the Bodhisattva concept, if you say, oh, this Bodhisattva stuff is all stupid, if you start to develop that idea, your IQ actually starts to drop, especially with regard to spiritual things. So that would be that kind of person would start to degenerate in their wisdom. Wisdom, in its most basic meaning, is the ability to analyze things. And that would start to degenerate if you degenerated in other parts of your life. And it does start to degenerate. Your Dharma ability to analyze Dharma starts to degenerate. You shouldn't take your vows from a person like that. Kylie, you had a... No. Okay. That finishes the teacher, okay? Now he says, by the way, we're not out of number one yet. We're not out of the request yet. Okay. It's getting done. But anyway, he says, what should the person requesting do? I mean, what should he be doing at that time? As you'll see in your reading, you have to make the place really beautiful. The place should be really, really nice, well cleaned. There should be nice paintings around, or there should be a main image of Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha, the teacher. And then there should be other images behind that image. Should be images there. The teacher should be up on a throne, the Lama from whom, or the person from whom you're going to take the vows. By the way, as you'll read in the readings, you don't even, these are one kind of vow that you can take without a, you can take it from an image of the Buddha, yourself. If there's no one within 1,000 miles that you can get to, and the scripture says that, you know, it says if there's no one within any kind of reasonable traveling distance, you know, if all the lamas are in Tibet and you're in America, and you can't get to one, you just literally can't get to one, it's allowed to take these vows by yourself before an image. But very much discouraged. I mean, it doesn't mean that if Rinpoche's down in Howell, New Jersey, and you're lazy, that you can just take them from your altar. But it is, there is a ritual that you can do. It's in the scripture, and you can study it.
You can take probably most of us?
No. That's why the nuns' vows broke, because there weren't enough nuns to make it. It takes a certain number of nuns to ordain a new nun. So if those nuns were made to disrobe, which happened in Tibet at a certain time in history, then there weren't enough nuns to make new nuns. Full nuns.
Wait, what happens to the core requirements of, you know, breaking a vow and intent to break it and all of that kind of stuff in terms of being able to fix it to be able to make a new nun?
Oh yeah, you don't have it in its complete form. You don't have it. You don't have that benefit. You can kind of think that the Buddha was there. And you don't have that direct benefit of a human being.
Yeah. How far to this wisdom? A lot of people with right motivation, some capital, like the liberating of his dogmatist, the dialectics, and you get to a very subtle level of something.
Well, the main wisdom is the dividing right and wrong. That's the main wisdom. It's not dialectic. Knowing what's the right thing to do and what's the wrong thing to do. That's the main function. Okay. He says, first you should go to that lama, man or woman, touch their feet in respect, show respect to them. Then you should offer them a mandala. The traditional mandalas were very beautiful. It's fates. They didn't use rice. You had to go pick rose petals. You had big piles of petals. And you'd be doing this mandala with these huge piles of rose petals.
Mandala offering,
you say, not create a mandala. Right, a mandala offering. Then it says you have to make a request 3 times to show that you really want it. Because if you don't want it, it won't grow. If you don't really want it, it won't grow. So you have to ask 3 times. Then it says you have to kneel down. There's two ways of kneeling in Buddhism that are accepted. Either way, okay. One is what Rinpoche calls chicken. When he says sit like a chicken, he means like this. Okay. We have to do that in Sojo for like 45 minutes. It's very uncomfortable. That's like that. It's just crouching really. And then you can take your bodhisattva vows like this also. That's also in the scriptures. So he says,
you got on one knee, right?
Yeah, genuflecting.
One knee or two?
On one knee, on your right knee.
Michael, your hands are not this way.
The book says like this. The book says like this. But normally, in the lineage, when we take a vow, it's like this. And when you do your tunduk and you take your vows in there, or you're reasserting your vows, you're supposed to hold your hands like that. Huh?
What?
It's just making it swearing. Oh. Okay, that's the student side. Then from the lama side, it says he should talk to the person about the benefits of the bodhisattva vow. He should try to explain to the person what's the use of taking the bodhisattva vow. And there's this scripture that says if you took all the Buddhas on all the planets in the universe and you gave them all offerings, or if you took the bodhisattva vows and never kept them very well, you get more virtue from taking the bodhisattva vows and not keeping them very well. It's a beautiful thing. If you could get all the Dalai Lamas in all the universe and make them offerings, it's not as powerful as taking the bodhisattva vows and not keeping them very well. Okay? I mean, a lousy bodhisattva is better than this ability to offer on all the planets of the universe to all the Buddhas in the universe. That's
why?
One thing. Excuse me?
Why?
We'll get there.
The Buddhas had everything to begin with, so what do they need?
It comes in another book, and we'll discuss it sometime. There's a
promise.
Long, no, there's a long story about it. The teacher should explain to the student which vows are more serious and which are less serious. I mean, which one of them is more serious and which one of them is less serious. And then the teacher should try to... by the way, if you take your bodhisattva vows, and then let's say you break the vow, the second vow, which is to give someone something they really need, and you're the one who can give it, and you have it, and you can give it, and you're in a position to give it, and they're totally depending on you. And then if you don't give it, and you break that vow, you get a very horrible rebirth. I mean, the teacher has to explain to the student which vows are more important, and which ones are more serious. Maybe in some cases, better not to take the vow. I don't know. Then he should make the student happy.
In what sense?
There's a thing called sanktapa, which means sooner or later you're going to have to take these vows. I mean, you don't have any choice, actually. You know, I mean, you can say, I don't want to take them now, or they sound nice, but I'm not a really Buddhist, and I'm not really interested in them. But even for your own liberation, really, ultimately, for your own Buddhahood, you must take the vows. For you to get the virtue to create the kind of paradise that we described in the last course, you must take these vows.
So a Buddhist then?
Millions of times.
How did the first one happen? I mean, there was nobody there.
There was no first one.
I mean, to give the vows and to do all the ritual and the whole thing, I mean, it must have grown.
There was no first one. You should take the last course, the vows, and the mental continuum.
Mixed and having to give them
the vows. No, it means explain to them the benefits that they're going to get out of it, that they must take it. That sooner or later, you have to take it. If you want to really reach paradise in this life, you must take this life.
Why take the vows for which? And why do it?
We talked about it in the first class.
Four advantages.
Four benefits. Taking a vow in front of a lama means there's a benefit that if you're ever close to breaking the vow, you think of him or her, and it helps you stop. Because you'd be embarrassed if that person found out about it. And there are three other benefits which you can. I'll give you the reading. That's like the main one. We're gonna go to 9:30, okay?
Yeah.
Stop asking questions, really.
We'll take a break, and then we'll come back. Try to come back like in 10 minutes, about 8:30. If you have any burning questions, come to me right now. And one thing is collect salt. What's salt?
Yes.
Salt means a collection of anything. Collecting a collection, okay. Collecting a collection means you involve all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You say, come and watch me take the Bodhisattva vows. It's very heavy because they actually have the power to come. You can't see them. This is preliminary number two. Collect salt. What? You're asking all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the universe to come watch you take the vows. Big audience. Okay. Very serious vows. They say much more serious than even taking a monk's vows. You've got more people there. You also at that moment are supposed to, I mean, they do come. You can't see them. You don't have the karma to see them. They are there. But you're supposed to try to recall how fantastic they are, you know, what great qualities they have. These real bodhisattvas standing around you, real Buddhas standing around you, they're going to watch you take the vow. That's the second one. We're in preliminary number three. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the, you actually, that's where you actually get down on your knee and you make the, and you say, please grant me them quickly. There's a point in the ceremony where you say, come on, please, let's go. You say, I really want them now. I want them, please give them to me quickly.
Did you find my heart in a request?
Request to grant quickly. That's the third one. Feel joy. This is where you reflect on the there's a certain level of karma you can collect by keeping your morality, by not killing people, not stealing things, and things like that. But the level of karma that you can collect with the bodhisattva vows is indescribable, and you're supposed to take some kind of joy in it. If you understand emptiness well, and if you understand the collection of karma well, which people who took the last two courses should, and understand the life, how your life stream, your mind stream goes on through lives, then you know that if everything is a projection, you're going to need some powerful, powerful projections to reach a state of paradise. For you to project the paradise onto an empty world is going to take very, very immensely powerful karma. This is the one that does it. This is the one that can get you there. It's very interesting. If you want to reach that place, you must take bodhisattva vows and you must keep them. And if you're having a sort of a lousy life and nothing's going very cool, and nothing exciting happening because you didn't keep the vows. If you keep the vows, things will start popping, and your Buddhism will change, and your life will change, and your world will change, and things will start to happen. Very exciting things will start to happen to you if you keep the vows. And if you don't keep them, you'll be just like this. just go on like that. It's really true that things are empty. It's really true that your karma fills in the picture. And it's really true that this is the most intense way to collect the karma, to fill it in a very fantastic way. So you must take them and you must keep them. You feel some kind of joy that you even have the opportunity to collect that kind of energy. What, especially if you understand emptiness, you'll appreciate it. I'm not allowed to tell you much about monk's vows or how we take the vows, but I can tell you that there's the same part in the ceremony for making a monk, a full monk. One of the monks is called the Sangten, has to take the monk out of the ceremony to a separate location, and he has to ask him certain questions. Like, do you know that, are you 20 years old? Do you want to become a monk? Do you have these and these and these problems with your life that you couldn't become a monk? Do you really intend to keep the vows? And there's a whole long list of questions that you have to ask the person. In other words, you're asking the person if there's anything that might obstruct them from taking the vows. In the case of the bodhisattva vows,
there are two main concerns. First of all, you're asking the person, do you have munsem? Do you really want to be a Buddha? Do you have the wish to help other living beings? Or at least is that somewhere in the back of your mind while you're taking this ceremony? Aside from the discomfort in your knee. Do you have that? And then secondly, do you really want these thoughts? Or were you forced? Or are you coming here because everyone else in the group is coming? Or, you know, or do you really want them? Do you really intend to keep them? He has some more later. He says, you know, are you coming here because other people got bodhisattva vows and you want to make sure you get bodhisattva vows? Were you forced? Do you basically understand the vows? Do you understand what you're getting into? Do you believe that you will be able to keep these vows? Jungsei. Anybody know Jungsei? Jungsei means a little bit. It's very interesting that Tsongkhapa uses the word. It means, okay, we all know we can't keep them perfectly, maybe, but do you really feel in the bottom of your heart that you will be able, to some extent, to keep these vows? Do you think you'll be able to keep them pretty well? That's one of the questions that the person is supposed to ask. The person is supposed to answer, not too bad. Supposed to be, yeah, that's the meaning. Being
asked. The person asked. All of them are activities of the person.
How about being, that's a good point. You have to have the lama's going to ask you. Are you doing this to help all living beings? And do you really want these vows? Those are the two main questions. Then he'll say, do you understand what the vows are? Are you trying to compete with anybody else? Are you here out of jealousy? You know, are you here for some bad motivation, or do you really want these vows? That's supposed to be that part. That finishes the preliminary. Now we go to the mercy. The lama says three times, will you take the bodhisattva vows from me? And the person says yes three times, and that's the end. That's the main event. I said 30 seconds, probably less. He repeats three times, do you want to take the bodhisattva vows from me? And the person says, I accept those vows. Three times, and then that's it. It's in the Tunduk we do. It's also in the Daki. Chantichito is simply key, but that's actually Nagarjuna's own word. That's the wording from Nagarjuna. Okay, the Jukchok, which is what?
Conclusion.
You have a question?
Is there ever an opportunity to really interact with a person when you take a vow so you can actually know whether or not they're fulfilling some of the requirements?
Whether they have the qualifications?
Right, like we're talking about on the section, whether or not they're.
Yeah. They say that you should observe the person for 12 years.
So then how can we take the vows at the end of this class?
You're not going to take them from me, you're going to take them from Rinpoche. But really, seriously, it's a heavy karmic relationship to establish with someone. And traditionally, you're supposed to watch the person for a long, long time. When Atisha, at the risk of his life, you know, took a sailing boat in the 10th century to get to Indonesia to learn this subject. When he got there, he didn't jump off the boat and go to Serlingba. He waited. And he waited for, I don't know, months. He questioned everybody. Is he a good lama? Have you heard any stories? Is he doing everything good? How are his students? Are they pretty good? You know, and he didn't go, you know, he risked his life, spent months getting there in this creaky ship, and then didn't introduce himself right away. First he checked him out. And that's a requirement. You should do that. Okay. Jukcho.
So Michael, people aren't going to know the name of the tradition. But your
reputation. Well, he's the greatest lama in the world. I mean, it'd be an honor to take him from him. Be a great honor. I don't even know if you'd be able to. You have to see. Yeah.
Does the candidate ever question the lama as to whether or not the lama has the necessary qualities?
You should ask. There's a famous exchange where one of the Mongolian princes told, I forget who it was. He he said to a lama, I've been checking for you for 12 years, and now I've decided that you're okay. And the lama said, well, now I'll have to watch you for 12 years. And he never got his bump. Yeah.
Doesn't teachings of giving dogs, usually like the lama will say what their background is sometimes, so that you know, they know that you should.
You, if you're going to do it the right way, you should really be like a private detective, and you should just check the person out as thoroughly as you can. You should really dig into their qualifications. It's not enough to say, you get a piece of paper, because you get all these pieces of paper in the United States. He's the head of the so-and-so sect, and the reincarnation of, you know, so-and-so, and stayed in the cave for 20 years, and, you know, all of the papers say that. You have to go check it out. We often get these papers, and they turn out to be, and in one case, it turned out to be some guy we knew from the neighboring village in India. You know, we knew the guy. He's just an old Joe Schmo in India. You know, and you should see the paper was like that. He called us, and we didn't believe who it was. Jukcho. That's the conclusion, which doesn't mean to say he wasn't a great. I don't know. This is going to have four parts. It sounds like superfluous. The Buddha is the all-knowing one. He knows everything anyway. But this is where you say to the Buddha, you face the Buddha image that's there, and you say, I just want to make sure that you understand that I am swearing to keep these vows. Face the Buddha image and you say, I just want to make sure that you, which only represents the real Buddha, right, that you understand that I'm swearing to keep these vows. Very heavy. And then you have to make three prostrations in each direction. I mean, people who are in Arizona, you remember the Dalai Lama did that before he gave the vows. How many directions in Buddhism? Okay. Usually 10. Four cardinal, four ordinal, up and down.
Hard to prostrate.
Yeah. So you prostrate in the four directions, and then for the up and down, you prostrate again to the east and again to the west. Okay? In case you wondered.
All right. But here you only prostrate in four directions.
Excuse me?
Here you only prostrate
in
four directions.
No, you should.
In six.
Really, it's six. So it's four, and then three more to the east, and three more to the west.
Prostration is still part of 3A?
Yeah, still part of 3A. This is, again, there's a very rare word in Tibetan. It's called sangtapa, and it's where you try to put somebody up. You try to pump them up by describing what a great thing they just did. And the classic reference to quote is, and there's many, that when the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are all sitting in their paradises on their particular Dharma thrones, and then suddenly all the Dharma thrones start flopping up and down and shaking like it's an earthquake. You know? And they all use their ESP to communicate. And they say, what the hell is going on? You know, what's happening? And somebody said, and then they check with their wisdom, and they see that Cheryl took her bodhisattva vow. And that's actually supposed to be true, that when someone takes their bodhisattva vows on earth, that it even shakes the thrones of the Buddhas. It's such a mighty event in history that someone is fortunate enough to take the vows, that these Buddhist thrones start to shake, and they start to, what's going on? And they check with their knowledge, and they see that someone has taken their bodhisattva vows. And then they say immediately after that, they enter into a relationship with that person which is unique. And they look on that person as their daughter or their son. They take on the relationship of a parent to a child. Then they're much more actively trying to lead you along and to protect you and make sure you're gonna make it.
How's that spelled?
Excuse me?
How do you spell that?
Which one?
The Tsun didn't get any further.
Sangtapa. This is a difficult word to spell. In English. Oh, that's easy. Okay. Third one. We're almost done. Actually, we're on time. We did this yesterday, if you remember, in the ceremony at the end. That's, sometimes it's a mandala offering. It's called Thangrak, and it means
out of thanksgiving for what has gone on. Actually, this is not only done by the students and the Lama, but it's done by the Lama and the student together to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas who are watching. You're thanking them for that because of them you've been able to have this ceremony for the person to take their vow. This is concluding part number four. Last then, concluding. Concluding of the conclusion. It says, don't advertise it. And Tibetan means don't run out in the market and announce it.
But if somebody asks, you can't.
Well, Jetsokab, it's not a secret vow. The point is not that it's a secret vow. You can tell other people about it, you can describe it to other people. But the point here is that if the other person does not have great faith in this whole bodhisattva ideal, if they think it would be stupid for a person to live for others, to give other people all the advantage and to take all the loss themselves, you know, if they think that's a stupid idea, or that's just, you know, watching out for number one is the right thing, and being the last one on the bus is the most stupid thing you could do, and giving up all the profit in a situation to the other person and taking all the loss onto yourself voluntarily as a spiritual practice, particularly if they're a person who thinks that would be a stupid thing to do, you're not allowed to tell them about this whole vows and what they stand for and what you did, and because the reason they think it's stupid is that they already have some kind of karmic obstacle. They already have some kind of tumor in their spiritual brain. And they really can't understand what the hell you're doing by letting other people go first and you go last. And so then to try to impress on them what a great thing it is, and then they would normally react even more negatively, that tumor would become more serious. It would actually thicken in their spiritual heart. It'd get worse. So you're not allowed to... You'd actually be hurting them. Because then their block, their obstacle would become more firm. So you're supposed to lay off. It doesn't mean that you can't go and tell all your Dharma friends that you got your Bodhisattva vows, because that's a great thing. That's a wonderful thing. It means don't go to someone who has no faith in the process and in the ideal and tell them what a great thing you did, because they'll just get more negative.
Why is that?
They would make fun of you, they would ridicule the idea, they'd say that's a stupid thing to do, and by doing so they collected bad karma. And that bad karma would make their old bad karma worse. More thick. That's about it. Okay, Mr. Kylie. The world is empty. If you study the Diamond Cutter, you know that. What you experience is your projections forced on you by your karma. And the Bodhisattva bells are that ultimate karma that will lead you to heaven. If you want to go to paradise, that's the only way. You know, you have to take those vows, and you have to keep them. If you don't keep them, or if you keep them in a half-hearted way, or if you don't even know them in the first place to keep them, which is normally the case, you just won't get any result. And you'll be one of those Dharma practitioners. You meet them from time to time. They've been practicing for 20 years, and nothing's happening. And they say... And they start to lose faith, or they start to have their midlife Dharma crisis. I've seen it. And they're wondering, what's going on? You know, why is nothing happening? And I've been trying so long and so hard, and nothing's really happening. And it's because they didn't learn the vows, and then they didn't make a real, honest, daily effort to keep them. Because if you do, things start happening. And that's the whole point. Okay, yeah. We'll do Madhava for Sahana. People who took the weekend thing, Michael Wick has some materials in English, the Dakye.
Yeah.
Tom Kiley's offered to help people if they have trouble on specific points of it and stuff like that. And you can talk to Cheryl about it, or Tom.